Good evening, and welcome to our program hosted by the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley, and WonderFest, the Bay Area Beacon of Science. My name is Tucker Hyatt, the founding director of WonderFest. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Robert Burton, author of A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, What Neuroscience Can and Cannot Tell Us About Ourselves. Dr. Burton received his undergraduate degree from Yale University and completed his medical doctorate and residency at the University of California at San Francisco Medical School. At the age of 33, he was appointed chief of the Division of Neurology at Mount Zion UCSF and subsequently became associate chief of the Department of Neurosciences. Alongside his two rich and deep nonfiction books, Dr. Burton has written three critically acclaimed novels. He also wrote the popular Salon.com column on neuroscience called Mind Reader. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming a man who stands with one foot in literature and one foot in the sciences, Dr. Robert Burton.
That's so nice, I think I'll quit. Let me just get my bearings here. How many of you people believe that one day science will explain the mind? Okay, I got a task set out for me. 2,500 years and no one has an idea of what the mind is, really, if you think about it. And yet in the last 20 years, there's been an enormous amount of progress in terms of neuroscience. But I'm going to start off with a couple caveats. And I think this Escher drawing of a man's hand drawing itself should stand as a cautionary tale. As we get better tools, fMRI, various forms of intracellular recordings, etc., we have a general feeling of enormous, almost logarithmic progress in the sciences compared to the dark ages of neurology when I first started. And we are looking to new tools. But keep in mind that unlike any other branch of the sciences, neuroscience is examining the brain, not the mind. But the choice of which tools use and how they're used, from the choice of how to set up your fMRI to what you're looking for to the statistical techniques you use to the conclusions you draw are done by the mind. So in effect, the mind chooses the tools to examine itself. Now think about this. If you have a microscope, you look to see if it has any smudges that are going to obscure what you're looking at, somehow distort the image. So I thought tonight we would look at the smudges of the mind examining itself. But meanwhile, while I'm standing here looking like I'm maybe a little bit of a naysayer, keep in mind this is not a naysay talk. I'm 100% in favor of science. There is nothing else. I'm not knocking anybody. I just want to point out some limitations. This is just a little way of stepping back and getting a breath of fresh air on how we look at ourselves. Okay. And I think my whole talk will be summed up in the next slide. I was at the locker room, my local health club, and one of my colleagues was telling me about the enormous amount of neuroscientific literature that's coming out, and he said, there is so much information, I have trouble keeping up with reality. He said it with a perfectly straight face. But if you remember nothing else from tonight, I think this is the talk, is if you think about it, we have some concept of information. We have scientific method. We have reproducibility. We have all the things that have made science what it is. Anybody here know what reality is? And if they do, please take the plane to Sweden so you can be first in line. We don't know what reality is, but so it exists in two forms, one of which I wanted to discuss tonight. Reality actually exists as a concept, for what it's worth, some metaphysical conundrum. And it also exists as a feeling tone. You feel something is real. So what we're left with is neuroscience is about information. Reality is about subjective experience. And this is the holy grail of neuroscience, how you get from cells and neurons and synapses and emergent behavior into what you feel. And so, despite this sort of large gap, we have entered an era whereby people kind of jump over the gap by talking about two levels of interpretation at one time. And so I called a few simple headlines from the peer-reviewed journals. And the first one is possible site of free will found in the brain. Does that make sense to anybody? Secondly, what does free will mean? I mean, what other kind of will could there be? On free will? So you think about this. How did that slip in there? This is a theological construct from St. Augustine, perhaps, or earlier. But this neuroscientist asked this question for a reason, because he was taking his concept of a mind and trying to explain it with the latest tools. So how about this one? How many people believe that pain is not real? But what it amounts to is we've gotten ourselves in the situation whereby scans, etc., are become the defining nature of what something is. And real, once again, gets back to the comment about reality versus information. I thought this one was particularly spectacular. They found areas of the brain that lit up on fMRI when people were exposed to snakes. And they found that they could alter the behavior with transcranial magnetic stimulation. Therefore, the conclusion was, maybe we could change a person's level of courage. Well, courage is a concept. It's not something that resides in the brain. There isn't an area of the brain that's hot on courage. But which leads me to the one I think that's really spectacular. This is where a group of women didn't respond adequately to a pornographic movie, and it was decided that the problem was in the brain, not the mind, because fMRI showed decreased activity. And I thought, there's some fundamental confusion afoot here. But the problem gets back to that sentence, brain versus mind, which is the old standby of psychiatry versus neurology, which, if nothing else, I'd like to begin and leave you with this thought, that the part of the problem is the biology of how the brain works, the biology of thought, is not at all the same as the experience of thinking. And yet it is the experience of thinking that tells us how to think about the biology of thought. And I'll give you a perfect example. If you're trying to remember Joe Blow's name and you cannot remember it in the middle of the day and you try really hard, you have a feeling that you thought about it, and you have a feeling of how much effort you put into it, and you whiffed. You can't come up with the name. Now you wake up the next morning with Joe Blow's name and you go, it just occurred to me. And you go, in the first situation, you had a very strong sense of thinking. In the second situation, you had no sense of thinking. You woke up with it. Now, two possibilities. Either we think differently when we're thinking about something or when we're not, or it's the same process with an additional feature. And if you think about it, since we realize the majority of our thoughts occur in a complex subliminal way, it makes no sense to say, for example, that your heart beats differently when you're aware of it than when you're not. It doesn't make any sense to say you think differently when you're thinking about things and when you're not, but what you have is the difference is you have the experience of thinking. And this experience of thinking leads us to believe in such things as reason, rationality, lines of reasoning, etc. So what I'd like to address is how does our brain shape our concept of a mind? And to go back for a second, I'm going to just cover a couple items that I had in my previous book as sort of a warm-up, because it sort of leads you into how I thought about this in the first place. So let me ask you people, how many of you remember absolutely where you were when the shuttle blew up? Absolutely. You're certain you remember all the details? Now, what's interesting to me is this has actually got me started thinking about this whole problem about sensations in the mind, is that they did a study on 100-odd people in which the Challenger blew up, 2.5 hours later, people went to the class with a notebook and they wrote down everything that they had, where they were, all the fine details. And then the guy collected the notebook and 2.5 years later asked him again. And as you might expect, memories morphed over time, and the vast majority of people did not get the details correct. Only 25% got them proximally correct, and only 10% got them completely correct. Now, I want to emphasize that only 10% got them completely correct. They repeated this with the 9/11. And now, of all you people who raised your hands saying you were absolutely certain where you were, raise your hand now. And see, really, the problem is it's always the other guy. Way down deep, that 10% all applies to the same people. Nobody believes that their memories are not accurate. And what struck me about this particular study was not that people don't get it correct. It's how they explain it away. And this is a sentence that actually got me started on this whole project. That's my handwriting, but that's not what happened. Now, it's hard to imagine saying that. I mean, you would feel profoundly stupid, but it didn't bother this guy. And it really, and that is, but you, people all just raised your hand anyhow, too. So there were two pivotal studies in two patients that I saw that really kind of have changed the way I thought about the way the brain works. The first one was a lady who got an encephalitis, a viral infection of her brain, and she developed this very rare syndrome of Cotard syndrome, in which she thought she was dead. And it's been well described as very rare, but at any rate, when I said to her, take your pulse, and she said, yes, I have a pulse, so what do you conclude? It means that, she actually said also, it means that dead people have a pulse to me, and as well as my beating heart could not be evidence for being alive. Now you think that's not possible. But what was interesting is it was a neurologic disorder, and when it cleared up, when her encephalitis cleared up. Though she remembered it very clearly and had no accountability for why that happened. And the other one which struck me is an elderly man with, older than me, who with, had a minimal stroke. He recovered within a few hours. He went home and he phoned me in a panic because he was an antique dealer and he had a desk that had a lot of wormholes. It was a huge refectory table that was like 12, 14 feet wide. And he said, my desk has been replaced by a Levitt's imitation. And I said, well, does it have the same wormholes? He said, yes, the exact same location. Everything was identical. So he agreed objectively it was exactly the same. But he said, it no longer feels familiar. It feels unfamiliar. It's not mine. Someone stole it and he called the cops. So I was, and I remembered, one of the reasons I actually went into neurology was a neurosurgeon by the name of Wilder Penfield, who did a study in the early 60s, which he recorded 25 years of experience on stimulating the limbic system, temporal lobe in the brain, and described all the non-motor phenomena. And one of the most obvious ones is deja vu, a sense of extreme familiarity, and people described a sense of realness. And on the other hand, they describe bizarreness, strangeness, otherworldliness. They describe a sense of knowing or not knowing. So they described two poles of mental sensations ranging from familiar to unfamiliar, etc. At the same time, I remember in William James' piece, section from his Varieties of Religious Experience, in which he describes people who had spontaneous epiphanies or mystical experiences, if you want to talk about it that way, also induced with, at that time, various drugs, ether, and chloroform, and now more recently with drugs like PCP and ecstasy, ketamine. People describe a sense of infinite knowledge, but without any particular subject for which the knowledge applies. Just like when the Penfield experiments were, when he stimulated the brain and they felt a sense of something, it wasn't attached to an object. It wasn't like that feels familiar. It was a sense of familiarity. So William James made this comment, which has always stuck in my mind, that mystical states, although they're similar to states of feeling, also feel like they're states of knowledge. And it occurred to me that there are some feeling tones that we have that feel like knowledge, but they're not knowledge in the sense of some objective phenomena. And then I went back to the Challenger study and the shuttles, and I said, it seems to me there's some fundamental problem that's not psychiatric or psychological about cognitive dissonance. We can argue about how it developed. Maybe it develops on a psychological basis, but the net long-term underlying substrate for this is some physiologic phenomena that overrides our sense of reason. So we have a contrary feeling that is greater than any knowledge we have. And I think you can understand this best in terms of an aha. None of us can generate an aha. It happens to you. It is a spontaneous event. And I think most of you can see the difference between 2 plus 2 equals 4 and equals mc squared. I think everybody here has a feeling that 2 plus 2 equals 4 not only is correct, but that it feels correct. How many here feel that E equals mc squared is correct? Usually the physicists will answer yes, and a few mathematicians, but the most people go, I know that's right, but you don't feel it's right. Okay. So from all these various lines of evidence, it's pretty clear that we have feelings about our thoughts that are not consciously generated. They occur, they bubble up, they happen to us, they're involuntary. Okay. So why would that be? If you think about it for a second, if you have a thought, it can never be stopped by another thought, a pure thought. If you say so-and-so about it, yeah, but on the other hand, this is, goes on ad infinitum. What we need physiologically is something that stops thought cold as saying, yeah, that's right. And so it has to overwhelm the thought into saying it's right, and that's a stopping point. At the same time, we need to have some sort of mental sensations that allow us to proceed into the future. For example, you need to have, let's say you're going to sit down and write a novel. You would never start a novel if you didn't think an idea was going to turn out to be novel worthy at some point down the road. You got to have some hunch if you're going to do a long-term science project. But you can't know it's right because you haven't done it yet. So you need to have a standalone feeling of, I'm on the right track. And this is what, unfortunately, is perceived as the phrase gut feelings or hunches and so on, and intuitions. But the fact of the matter is these are Formfrust, or what I would call minor versions of an aha. They're not the full-blown thing. They're itty-bitty little ahas saying, I think I'm on the right track. And so this is physiologically necessary, and without that, we would never have complex thought. We would have to have some guiding feature. But here's where I want to spend a couple of minutes. So let's take a look at how this reward actually works. And one moment of science, of modest science. In our reward systems, one of the predominant, although not the only, neurotransmitter is dopamine. So let's take a monkey, and we will put intracellular electrodes in its reward system, and then this, if you follow this, you'll see that it has a baseline rate of dopamine firing. Okay, now, because we're real nice, we give the monkey some juice, squirt it in its mouth. And right after that, we see dramatic elevation in dopamine levels. This is Pavlov's experiment made more elegant through modern science. Okay, perfect. Now, let's give it a light, flash the light. Dopamine goes up, and then it gets the juice. Initially, the reward was for the juice. But after it becomes trained, the reward is no longer for the juice. The reward occurs, in terms of the elevated dopamine, occurs prior to receiving the juice. And the reason is that the brain works as a predictive mechanism. And what it's, instead of rewarding the juice, it's now rewarding the accuracy of the prediction in advance. So when it sees the light, it goes, oh, I'm going to get the juice. Bingo, it gets the reward. And then when the juice comes, sort of like foreplay. So now let's take away the juice. And what you see is initially it gets a sense of reward, and then there's a sense of unfulfilled expectation. The dopamine levels dramatically fall. Now, think about this. This is the mechanism. If you think of this as the mechanism whereby thought is rewarded, okay, as long as thought's going as we expect it to go, things are the way you expect it to be, you get the reward, things are fine. It doesn't happen. You have a sense of frustration, disappointment, unfulfilled expectation. And you can see how this is an enormously powerful tool for keeping you having the same thoughts. It's also, you could see that, if, to back this up, this would be like an addiction, and this would be like withdrawal. So two things, and what never really occurred to me first few years of thinking about this is that the brain works predominantly as a predictive organ. Predictive, and it's, if you think about it, then it's got two categories that selectively create a thought. One is computation. It computes what's going to happen, so this monkey's thinking about what it's going to get, and then it has a qualifying sensation about that computation. Ah, I got the juice, or oops, juice didn't come. These are two separate aspects which collectively make up thought. And it's the discrepancy between the so-called cognitive aspect or the computational aspect of a thought and the sensations about it that I want to now talk about briefly. First of all, just think about it, although I have no idea this is correct, I'm going to just make a momentary speculation. If you take someone with obsessive compulsive disorder, and they turn off the gas, and then they go out of the house, and then they go, did I turn off the gas? They go back in, and then they see the stove is off. They go out, same thing happens, and it interferes with their entire life. You could see that as a disconnect between the computation, they see the gas is off, and the absence of that mental sensation that, yes, the gas is off. Now think about it the other way. In people with delusional states and schizophrenia, you could see this working the other way, that they have an overwhelming sensation of something being so, even if it's not so, that they can't shake. And you might even think about those most unpleasant people of all, the know-it-alls, as being addicted in the same way to dopamine and rewards their thoughts in the same way that cocaine and alcohol stimulate the same systems. So this is just as an aside, but I think as we go down the road, you're going to see that sensations in the brain are going to sensations about your thoughts are going to be a new avenue of exploration. Okay, so with that in mind, I wanted to briefly give some shot at what a mind might be or might not be. Very simply, we all are proud of conscious thought, and we have, over the last few hundred years at least, have conceived of that really ill-founded idea of a rational man. I can't think of anything more harmful than that thought. But at any rate, just think about this. At most, you can remember 7 to 9 digits at one time, on average. I mean, some people who are savants can do better. And if you're lucky, you can remember maybe 4 objects at any one time. And the total length of time that information stays in short-term memory, RAM, if you think of a computer, but short-term memory, is 1 to 2 minutes. At the end of that time, it's gone. So you try and memorize a phone number. You take the area code, the prefix, suffix, 3. Okay, you can do that. It lasts a couple of minutes, unless you set out to commit it to memory. So if you take a look at this little diagram, the tip of the iceberg, which is an unknown quantity, is what we can do with conscious thought. The rest is done subliminally. So when I mentioned to you about this feeling of knowing and this, it finally dawned on me that there must be a sensory system for the brain's computations in general. If we think about the external world, we have hearing and vision. We think about the internal world, we have things like hunger and thirst. It would make sense that we need some way to send into consciousness some appraisal of what's going on with our subliminal thoughts. So we need some form of sensations. Now, I'm not entirely thrilled with the word sensation, and the phrase involuntary mental sensations is not very euphonious, but I can't think of a better one, so I've chosen it to, for the purposes of discussion. I'm open to suggestions, but it seems to fit the best. But once you think about the sensations, then we can start to think about how we can build a self out of the brain. First of all, we have area in the brain that I think most of you, for example, think that you feel like you're right behind your forehead. In some sense, your essence is there. Well, there's an area in the brain where you can stimulate it electrically, and you get out-of-the-body experiences, where you can be looking down at yourself. This also happens spontaneously to people with epilepsy. It can also be stimulated with certain drugs like ketamine and so on, where people can actually have out-of-body experiences. It's not something magical, it's not mystical, and it's not woo-woo, it's just chemistry. Now, to show the power of this, you can then take a person, fit them up with a virtual reality headgear in which the camera is placed on a nearby mannequin. And the person will feel like they're inside the mannequin. What's most interesting to me is that you can stab the mannequin and the person's heart rate will go up and he'll get sweaty and so on and feel anxious, even though he knows intellectually that he's here and that's a mannequin over there, but his physically feels like he's in the mannequin. And there are body swap experiments, there are rubber hand illusions and stuff that you guys probably do as parlor tricks, but what it amounts to is there is a physical sense of self that is generated within the brain as a large representational map of your body. And there is even a separate aspect, which is in people who had damage to their amygdala, they lose their sense of the interpersonal space. So instead of having whatever is your comfort zone, they tend to have none. This also occurs on a genetic basis in people with Williams syndrome. Young kids that come up and hug everybody, they have no sense of fear and they have no interpersonal space. So if we're wanting to build a self, we can say that there's a scaffolding that the brain creates of a representational map that can be altered chemically that includes both where you're located and space around you to some. Now, these representational maps not only include that sense of self, but they have a sense of ownership. For example, if you lift your arm up, you feel your arm is being lifted up, and you feel it's your arm. Now, if you go to a doctor, and he lifts up your arm, it's still your arm, but you don't feel you've done it. So you have a sense of ownership that I'm sure you people have read enough Oliver Sacks, whatever, realize that if you have an injury to an area of the brain, the right parietal region, you can oftentimes lose a sense of identity of the other side of the body. Now, let me just describe one patient just so you understand how this might apply to the mind. There was a woman who had a stroke in which she lost the identity of the left side of her body. So she looked at her arm and it didn't seem like it was hers. But she also had a ring on her hand. She'd been married for umpteen years. She lost the identity of the ring. When they took the ring off her left hand and they put it in her right hand, she now recognized it as her ring. So she had a body schema of her arm and leg that included something that was very, not her, but it was close to her. Now, if you think about this, we have a sense of our own thoughts. We have a sense of ownership of our own thoughts and a sense of ownership of our own mind. Now, if you realize that this can be altered on a physiologic basis, you might start to think about why is it that we have such a sense of uniqueness? There are a zillion books out now about what makes a human being's unique and different from the rest of the animal kingdom. But one of the real problems is that we have an inbuilt sense of uniqueness because it's mine. We have a very strong sense of, in the neurologic jargon, of mindness. That's M-I-N-E-N-E-S-S, mindness. This is me. This is my body. This is my action. So you think about it. Agency. There's this dispute about free will, which free will to me is probably a word that should be eradicated from whatever language it started. But people have a very strong sense of free will because they have a sense of agency, because they in fact feel a prediction, which is why I showed you the slide about the monkeys. They predict an event, and then they have some qualifying sensation about the event to make their bodies run smoothly. And the sense of agency is exactly that. It is the physical correlate of the computation that your mind makes when it makes an action like reaching for this cup of water. Okay. Now, same goes for thinking. We have a feeling of thinking. When we go to bed and we solve a problem, wake up in the morning and don't have a feeling of thinking, we develop other ways of describing it. I mean, there are 8 volumes of Paris Review describing authors all telling about how the muses affect them. But what they're all saying is the same thing. I woke up one day and there it was. And it feels miraculous because you don't have the sensation to guide you, so it feels like someone else has done it for you, just like going to the doctor's office and the guy raises your arm instead of you doing it. But it's the same thing. So we have feelings of thinking, we have feelings of effort, we have feelings of choice, but we have yet a further problem. We don't know which came first between the feeling and the actual event itself. If you think about baseball, baseball player stands at the plate, the guy throws the pitch. By the time he has even perceived the ball fully, it's halfway to the home plate, and then he has to swing. That's his reaction time in his swing. But yet, if you talk to a baseball player, Ted Williams said he saw the ball approach the size of a 50-cent piece, and Barry Bonds, to outdo him, said it was the size of a quarter. So they see it. They think they see the ball as it approaches the plate, and then they hit it. That's how it feels. And yet everybody knows that the swing starts as soon as the ball is leaving the pitcher's hand, and it's done through subliminal calculations of vectors, etc. So all high-speed sports is done where you could close your eyes at the end, and it makes no difference. So they call this the subjective backward reordering of time, and it is sufficient that we can't be quite sure which comes first, the thought or the confirmation of the thought. An example would be you're going down the street looking for somebody's house, and maybe you haven't seen their house in 20 years, so you say, I'm going to find Joe Blow's house, and it's dark, and you go along, and all of a sudden you say, I recognize Joe Blow's house. What happened is your brain was filtering through all of the various houses you're going by, and then it came up with one that it remembers being Joe Blow's house, and then it sent up into perception the image of Joe Blow's house along with the feeling of recognition. But it creates a time lag so that you get the perception, and then you feel you recognized it. So when we think we recognize something, though we sense that we did it consciously, it's part of this process. And it's the same thing as the reordering of time that's done with all high-speed sports. So this leads to a really strange question, which has puzzled me. I have no answer for, but we have a very strong sense of cause and effect based upon the proximity of two events in time and space. For example, if you stub your toe and you have immediate pain, no contest. Stubbed toe causes pain. So you lay down that kind of neural network for that. Now you stub your toe and a week later it causes pain. It's a little less certain. You stub your toe and a month later you've got knee pain. You're not sure. So the closer in proximity to time that one event leads to another, the more likely that one causes the other. As a result, when we think, we have a very strong sense that thought A causes thought B. It's just the way we think, and we refer to that rather euphemistically as a line of reasoning. If it works out, the other people might not think that, but you think that. And that creates a sense of rationality. But if you think about it, in the brain, there are literally zillions of connections all operating instantaneously. So you have a choice between thinking about the brain at an unconscious level operating in a linear, sequential, serial fashion, in which case the cells at most can fire 200 times a second, Or it's all happening in an instant. And if you take an analogy from artificial intelligence, where you have weighting of information so that you'll have a neural network with everything has got pluses and minuses, so to speak, it's more like a committee vote. That can all happen in an instant. And that creates the sensation of a thought. The final outcome of this will be a vote for whatever it is you're voting about. Now, we don't know how thought occurs. There's absolutely no way to tell whether or not we think sequentially and linearly as you see, if you think as you experience it consciously, versus in a parallel or all at once. And that's why sometimes people euphemistically refer to getting the big picture. And getting the big picture is sort of a, all at once you get an idea, the whole thing's, and then you frame it out, you flesh it out. So I mention this because if you start thinking about some of the difficulties I mentioned, this is the tool that neuroscience is using to set up its experiments. And there's a fundamental paradox. Involuntary brain mechanisms generate a sense of a unique, willful self in action, thinking, making deliberate, conscious choices, and even determining causation. And this is, so we go back to the first slide when you see the people studying free will with fMRI. It is our personal experience of what a mind feels like that generates the concepts of our mind. But let me, some people say, okay, the mind's the brain. Some people say the mind emerges from the brain. Some people say it's more in the brain, you got a soul. I mean, everybody's got their own opinion. I don't think anybody has a clue as to what the mind is in the largest dimension, but I want to present my own little pet idea, which may be dead wrong, but what the hell, you're here. And it's one of the things I think that bothers me is that, and why I stressed about the uniqueness and the mindness as sensations that your brain generates, is we feel very firmly that we're individuals with individual thoughts, individual minds, and that we're somehow unique. But let me present you a couple examples from the animal kingdom about group behavior. Now, slime mold is the somewhere between animal and vegetable, but it's probably a low-grade amoeba. Don't mean to insult the amoeba. But it apparently likes oat bran, and they stick it in a maze, and it will very quickly solve a maze problem. But what's fantastic is that these two researchers decided, well, let's see how good a maze it can really solve. And so they put oat bran in all the major cities in Japan. And within a short period of time, these oat bran, which are individual little cells that have merged together into one giant multinucleated cell, 100,000 or so, but it's still a unicellular multinucleated organism, no brain, no nervous system, can solve mazes of sufficient complexity that they were able to, by putting oat bran on the various major cities in Japan, completely recreate the Japanese railroad system. And this was a topographic map. And so they asked the author of the study if this was a sign of intelligence. And he said, it depends what you mean by intelligence. But this is a group effort. I don't know if you could call it agency or free will or all those kinds of words, but it's clearly intending to eat something, and it solves a complex problem. And the calculation, the mathematically, is the complexity. This was approximately the same thing as learning to ride a bicycle. So, but my pet argument for the day is the locusts. Locusts, when they're alone, they're solitary. They eat by themselves. They don't talk much. They're vegetarians, and they stay by themselves. When you get to a critical mass, their behavior changes dramatically. And I'm sure you've all seen people pictures of swarming locusts. And it turns out that this can be done by increasing the density of the population of locusts within an enclosed area. And it turns out it's done very simply that they have little hairs on the back of their legs that when they're in close proximity with others, that they stroke each other's legs. And there's a massive release of serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter. But what's interesting to me is that the locus physically changes with this process. And its brain, which is normally optimized for being solitary, eating, solitary acquisition of food, suddenly changes its entire visual cortex to being one geared for group acquisition of food. Their muscles and their thighs change, get 30% bigger, and they get this really interesting little marching movement where they, you put them in the container and they all start marching. And of course, the most dramatic thing is they also start eating each other. Now, it's interesting to me that in a group situation, they have different behavior, different brain, and that they have certain behaviors which we have. For example, imagine many of you have been at a concert and you've walked out of the concert and the guy in front of you is going really slowly and you start doing, and you know, you take these little marching steps and you say, I'm doing this so I don't step on the guy in front of me. Maybe you are, and maybe you're not. Maybe there's a group phenomenon that causes it. The point is, we have no way to even study that. And if you think about how neuroscience has been done, it's been done by studying sort of reductionist, we'll study this area of the brain, this set of cells. Group study of neuroscience is of incomprehensible complexity to even think about how to do that. But if you believe in evolution, and you believe that we're not different than the rest of the animal kingdom in some way, then there's a strong suggestion that in a group situation, we may well have something equivalent to a group mind, even though it's reflected in the individual brain. I mean, it still has to be reflected in the individual. But we've moved from thinking about ourselves as unique organisms to an organism that is complexly interacting with others and the environment. Now, a shred of evidence along this line is, years ago when I wrote my last book, On Being Certain, I showed this slide with a certain sense of smugness about how most everybody will see the upper line as being longer than the lower line. Is that correct? I mean, but we also know at the same time that the two lines are correct, and it's just this is an optical illusion. But it never dawned on me that it would be different in different cultures. This group from British Columbia took this same set of slides and they showed this to different tribes, different groups of people. And they found out that in less technologically advanced, or more, I use the word primitive, tribes, they don't see any illusion at all. They see no difference between the upper and lower line, and that this difference increases directly proportionate to education and technology. Their conclusion is that culture can affect something as basic as perception. And then they want to comment that 90%+ of all studies on behavioral psychology are done on Western undergraduate students, and they've done almost no studies in the outside world. Now, I just happened to read this morning that one of the ways that we think about self-awareness is whether or not we can recognize ourselves in the mirror. And it turns out that that's how we've judged dolphins and elephants and great apes and so on. And yet it turns out that this mirror test depends on your culture. That it's true that by everyone by the age of 2 just about recognizes in Western culture. But in some of the more primitive tribes, it's not true till the age of 6. It's completely different. This isn't because they're stupid or something. It's just because they have different cultural values and they see themselves differently. So I just want to finish up by making a general comment that this may sound a little bit out of school, but I think the way we think about the mind is dramatically shaped by biology, and it's why we're seeing some of the comments we are. For example, think of these two opposing comments. This one from Daniel Dennett: the idea that the mind is more than just the brain is profoundly naive and anti-scientific. On the other hand, with the same data, a UCLA professor says this confirms the independent existence of the mind. And again, it is the mind of the individual trying to conceive of the mind of us as a group. So here's some latest ideas that I'll float by you. We are moist robots. What we think of as free will is actually found in the unconscious. Now that is hard to grasp, but try this one. Free will is an illusion, but you're still responsible for your actions. And the last one, which I will leave you with, is psychology offers the hope that profound questions about the human nature can be answered in the lab. And my answer to that is, how do you put the world into a lab? And I think one of the problems that we're left with is we've painted ourselves into a corner in terms of thinking about the mind. And it's far beyond my intelligence to tell you what it is or isn't, but I just hope tonight I've given you some idea about other ways of at least thinking about what the mind might be. So, there we are.
Thank you, Dr. Burton, for your insights. Please come on over. We've got some questions from the audience. And I get to start with one of my own here. 20 years ago, Nobel laureate Francis Crick wrote The Astonishing Hypothesis, namely that, this is the quote, you, that is your joys and sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Unquote. Then, as now, the vast majority of people on Earth do not believe this. Should we believe it?
How many of you guys believe it? How many of you believe it? You know, what's interesting is that this is an evolutionary thing. When I was a resident, we had to have training in psychiatry, and everybody poo-pooed it because they said, well, there's psychiatry and there's neurology. And we were all often, is this thing working? Yeah. Okay. We were often called on to distinguish whether something was psychiatric or neurological, which is kind of ridiculous, but at that time it seemed like the right thing to do. So 40 years ago, that might have been an astonishing hypothesis because it came from prior to our present understanding of how the brain works. But it also is astonishing, I suppose, because it's contrary to what we feel, but it's not astonishing. It's astonishing we didn't think of it sooner.
I love the term neural correlate. Do we know the full neural correlate of any subjective sensation? And how much better must our equipment get, let's say fMRI technology, to allow identifying the neural correlate of, say, the smell of cinnamon or the sound of middle C?
If you take the best worked out system, which is the visual system, we have excellent knowledge of how individual cells work. And I would say that visual perception has been very well worked out, except that your red is still not my red. So what we've worked out is what we see at the level of how the brain sees it, but what we experience, we have no idea. So there is no neural correlate of experience. There's neural correlate of perception at the level of what you see going on in the brain. You do not, I mean, your tie pattern looks different to everybody in this room. Not so good to me, but to me, some people like it.
Sorry.
You know what I mean? So there's a difference between neural correlate at the level of the brain and at the level of experience. That's why I showed that slide.
What are your views about biological underpinnings, in quotation marks here, of religious beliefs? Parenthetically, religion seems to be very pervasive in all, even very primitive, human societies. And does this mean that the brain evolved to generate religious thinking and experiences?
Depends what you mean by religious, first of all, because two different things. There's no question that sense of when I talk about involuntary mental sensations, I sort of rushed through it because we didn't have a lot of time. But one of the ones that is most striking to me is the sense of purpose and meaning. And I think when this is not something that you can will, this is something that occurs to you. And I think you've all had the experience of feeling alive with the sense that everything is meaningful, what you're doing, and other times for no reason it disappears. Now you can't figure what's the point of anything. It's sort of the existential crisis. And we see commonly in people like with depression where it's suddenly meaning just disappears. That's clearly at one level biological. It comes and goes during our lifetime, and when we have it, we don't even notice it. When it's gone, it's appalling. Each of us has it to greater or lesser degree, and I think by the same token, we have a desire to explain that feeling. I'm a kind of like a person who doesn't really care what the feelings are if you have it. I mean, I don't care what you call it. So for me, it's great if life feels good. But most people have a strong desire to explain what they're experiencing, so they give it labels. And labels lead to things like the name religion. Now, if you're talking about religion as a belief system, that's quite something else again. That's not the same. There's a biological basis for a sense of purpose, and if that purpose becomes attached to an object, you might go that way. For example, they've done transcranial magnetic stimulation on people where they get this experience of oneness. And almost invariably when they do that, when people try to describe it, they describe it in terms of their religious upbringing. They can't just express it as inchoate, nonverbal feeling. So they attach something to it, and that starts to build its own neural network. Oh, yeah, when I had that feeling, it was when I was thinking about Hare Krishna or something. And then away you go. If that makes sense.
What is the... we're working here? What is the role of technology... What is the role of technology in influencing the nature of our thoughts?
One of the things I would like to spend more time on this evening, but is that our brain, if you were to... Do you remember those old jukeboxes where you have a dozen records? We probably have literally millions of representational maps that are interrelated for virtually everything. And one of the more interesting studies for me about the nature of a technology is the so-called monkey rake experiment. If you take a monkey who's never used a rake, and first you have him reach out for a peanut, and have electrodes inside the area of the brain that has this sort of template or neural system for a representational map for a sense of self, the cells will fire as long as the monkey's hand is within reach of the peanut, even if the hand is at its side. In other words, it knows how long its hand is. And you take a monkey who has no strong use of instruments in the wild, you give him a rake that's, say, another 8 inches long, and it learns how to use the rake to get the peanut. Within a week or two, those cells will start to fire whenever the distance includes the arm and the additional distance of the rake. The rake has been incorporated into the monkey's body schema. And this is the same sort of phenomena that I alluded to with the lady with the wedding ring. Now, I don't know about you, but when I see people with a cell phone like this, I would love to have electrodes in their cortex for more reasons than one. But because I'm pretty sure this has been incorporated into their body schema. And you even see the posture changing about people now as they're walking, looking. I mean, so all of technology is going to be incorporated if you use it enough. It's part of you after a while. I mean, it's part of your memory. You rely on it for a lot of short-term memory. Guys on rounds now, they have all their data at their fingertips, literally. I mean, that's a different way of having it at your fingertips.
What do you think about the speculation that all behavior determined in subconscious and conscious mind exists to provide meaning to actions after the fact, that our modern brain evolved to provide cover for our lizard brain?
I'm waiting to get the answer. It's coming to me.
You want to come back to that later?
No. I, if you, I mean, a lot of people believe that
most of what we tack on to our behavior is after the fact description. It's like it's first comes the film, and then they have after post film editing, in which they have a voiceover narrative. I mean, and in that's the popular view, like, for example, of morality, that morality comes at some very basic level, and that we provide it with language of meaning. It sounds good on the surface. I'm not sure that that's true, because I don't know whether morality is individual even.
Right.
So if it was extended beyond the person, for example, with some of the things you see that you can't, I mean, I see some of the customs that you see now in different other parts of the world, you go, how is that possible? Now, so it may be that the customs, like I showed that slide, the customs may influence your biology. And if it does, then it wouldn't be a lizard brain anymore. But I'm not sure of that. I'm not sure of anything. I should tell you that one of the reasons I spent this last 15 years is that people, I'm sure, have a huge spectrum of complete doubt, complete certainty. And I'm so far on this spectrum that even when I look back at my book today in preparation of coming here today, I say, who wrote this? And is that really true? I mean, just, but on the other hand, other people, so when you ask me a question, I preface everything by, huh?
So, we've had a couple questions here about meditation. Here, how does the study of the minds of monks like Matthew Ricard help to solve the challenges you have raised?
I'm not sure that you can turn off the brain with meditation in the sense that there's, now they refer to default networks, where even if you stop thinking consciously, things are still bubbling along underneath. But I think meditation is a superb way of having downtime for your brain to approach itself. In other words, and I think you're going to actually, there's going to be a speaker here talking about how, Daniel Levitin speaking on how downtime actually allows you creative time. So meditation, if by that you mean quiet, is really how people write. I mean, like when I try to write a novel or something, you sit quietly and hopefully things will occur to you. In other words, your subliminal brain will deliver up some message to you. It doesn't happen when the phone is ringing and everything else. So I think meditation is a, I don't know about structured meditation, but anything which is quiet and unobtrusive, where you allow your mind to wander, is a form of meditation. I don't mean daydreaming so much, but something where you're actively concentrating on nothingness the best you can.
Should we be able to one day transplant brains? Also, should we be able to download memories, knowledge, or thoughts?
You'd have to ask Ray Kurzweil that. There's a belief that we can, we science fiction really is probably the leading art form now, because it's thrilling to think that you can download all the good memories onto a hard drive, and maybe you can selectively delete childhood or whatever didn't go well. But I find that fascinating in movies, but for me, that feeling of reality does not seep into that question. Is that a nice way of putting it?
Are we moving more rapidly to an almost evangelical theory of rationality? How do we make it okay to be the rationalizing machines that we are? Rationalizing machines.
Well, I think that phrase is very nice, whoever wrote it. I mean, if we went away from the idea that we have a complex rational thought, but at the same time acknowledge that as an organism we make complex decisions that we can make in as educated a manner as is consistent with what we can acquire from scientific method and so on, eliminate what superstition you can. It's not exactly within our control on a one-to-one basis. You can't go out there and say, I'm going to eliminate everything, I'm completely rational. But over time, with learning, it's the same. I think being rational is probably like learning to be a concert pianist. Very few of us get there. But you can get somewhere down the road where at least you can play a tune. And so the idea of a rational machine is, I'm going to say something really out of school here also, is that smart people like to think they're smart. And there's nothing more enjoyable than a smart person telling you he's rational. And so rationality is pounded into our heads by people who are good at forensics. They're good at arguments. They're good at so-called browbeating the other person into intellectual submission. That is not the same thing as being rational, because you still have the same problems. So if I should come across a rational person, I will phone you. And really, the difference between us and computers in large part is because computers don't have feelings. It's not that they aren't going to pass us by, and most everything that is complex, I mean, I expect it will be, whether it's modeling for climate or whatever. But until such time as we understand the physiology and can reproduce the mental sensations that I mentioned, that separates us from machines. So I don't like to think of ourselves as machines. I like to think of ourselves as decision-making organisms.
We have time for one last question, and it's going to come from the last two sentences in this book. And Dr. Burton did not ask me to do this, but I love this book, and it'll be for sale out there in the lobby, so I just recommend you take a look at it. The second to last sentence in the book says, "The study of the mind is a data-based art form, not another branch of the basic sciences." Can you expand on that? And how would your colleagues in neuroscience regard that statement?
Well, that's why I started with the picture of the mind examining itself. A couple examples, maybe. There was data is data. Data can be subjected to whatever scientific methods are available, and hopefully over time we can sort out the good from the bad data and so on. So let's leave data and say, under ideal circumstances, you can get great data for those things that are objective. How you interpret that data is quite another matter. And I will tell you, there was one study that I found particularly bothersome in neuroscience not so long ago, where a very prominent neurologist, very well trained, top of his field, did a study on people with locked-in syndrome. And locked-in syndrome, if you remember the diving bell and the butterfly, is where you're left with a brainstem injury which you can only communicate by way of eye movements or blinking, usually by blinking. And this man went out to interview like 50 people with locked-in syndrome. Now you imagine they're all sitting there or lying there, and they're unable to move. And he did a questionnaire and asked them if they were happy. And the majority indicated that they were content with their care and that they were happy. It was like 48 out of the 60 or something like that. And the conclusion was that that people with locked-in syndrome were happy, and that therefore you should not make premature judgments about the role of euthanasia. Now, the data that he acquired as data, fine. But imagine sitting in a chair and you're dependent upon this doctor for your care, and you're dependent upon the hospital for your life in terms of, you know, taking care of you, and they ask you, how are you feeling? What are you going to say, terrible? I mean, are you happy with your care? So they put you in an untenable position. So now the question is, the data might be okay, but the way constructed the study is horrible. But the conclusion of the study was, we should call a moratorium on euthanasia in people with locked-in syndrome. Well, that's a religious decision. I'm not commenting on whether it's a good or bad idea, although you might be able to read my mind. But it's something that is not part of the data. We see this all the time where people have there's one study where this cardiac surgeon wanted to see whether massage, non-touch massage would help people in the post-surgical situation where they would do better if they had this non-touch massage. And he said that they did better. And he said, I had no a priori idea. Well, to me, why would you ever do a study like that unless you had some a priori idea? I mean, otherwise you would test whether or not lasagna rubbed on their chest was good for them. So to me, I think that science, and particularly science about something which is as abstract as the mind, I want to know what the person's biases are as best you can, what their underlying reasons for doing. And even if they don't know, we can tell a lot by people even when they don't know. So I'm in my book, and I don't think it'll ever happen, but even in peer-reviewed journals, I would love to see doctors put their own little autobiography. Scientists in general.
Thanks, Dr. Burt. I hope we all enjoyed this evening's program, brought to you by Wonderfest and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Dr. Robert Burton, author of A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, our audience here in Palo Alto, those of you joining us by radio, and two great event planners who helped to put the wealth in Commonwealth, Georgette Gahu and Kara Iwahashi. And now, this meeting is adjourned.